White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to the 63rd episode on this September 5th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And Hadding, we're going to be reading Chapter 58 tonight, which is titled Jewish Idea Molded Federal Reserve Plan. And it's a continuation from last week's chapter. And right at the beginning, I noticed that it mentioned something that I think we missed the significance of last week.
I missed it. Okay. It's all on me.
I said, I think we missed it. Did you not hear that? Man, you're so sensitive. I said, I think we missed it. And I know that I missed it. I wasn't sure if you did.
Yep, you sure missed it. Yep.
But I know that I did because... Well, you know, you don't want to be serious here. I'm being serious. In that questioning of Paul Warburg by Senator Bristow from Kansas, Bristow brought out that Paul Warburg did not become a U.S. citizen until 1911, and that what he was getting at was that he began working with Senator Nelson Aldrich and others quite a bit before that, designing the U.S. currency reform bill. And he was, as they say in the beginning of this chapter, an alien at that time. He was not a naturalized citizen yet. In fact, the trip to Jekyll Island, where all of this was finalized and decided upon, well, I guess, I don't know if it was finalized then, it was decided upon, it took place in 1910, and he was a major component of that, of the group of people there. And he wasn't a citizen of the United States. And I think that is something that, that the International Jew people and Henry Ford take as something people should have been, you know, should not really approve of, because they're very big on being loyal, patriotic Americans, real Anglo-Saxon Americans.
Yeah.
So I think both of us didn't quite pick up on that, but it's brought out in this one, and so I wanted to bring that up. And I just thought another thing is that Paul Warburg didn't come here by himself. His brother Felix was also here in the United States, which I wasn't clear on. And they both immigrated to the States. And Felix married Frieda Schiff, daughter of Jacob Schiff, and a banker and philanthropist. And Felix, it's not too important. And Paul married Nina Loeb. Now, this firm that they are with was Kuhn, Loeb & Company. You know, yes. Schiff never had his name on it. I was thinking, well, where's Schiff coming? But Schiff became head of Kuhn, Loeb & Company in 1885, before Warburg ever came over here, right about that time. And so then, you know, Felix married Schiff's daughter, and Paul married Loeb's daughter, and another one married Felix married... Schiff's daughter. Paul married Loeb's daughter, and somebody else married somebody in there. I'm confusing myself. Felix, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, they all intermarried with one another, and you know that's part of the problem with this company too. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say to start out before we start out. So you can start now.
Okay. Well, I want to put a caveat on something I said last week. Mm-hmm. I said that the federal debt goes up drastically at wartime and then slowly declines. Actually, that only happened after the First World War. I looked at some figures on a government website, and I'll post the link after the show. And after the Second World War, the debt actually, in absolute numbers, it never declined.
interesting.
As a percentage of the total gross domestic product, it probably did, but not in absolute numbers. Mm-hmm. All right. So this is chapter 58. Jewish idea molded Federal Reserve Plan. The last view the reader had of Paul M. Warburg in the preceding article was as an alien not naturalized, secretly closeted with Senator Nelson W. Aldrich and a party of bankers on an obscure island off the southeastern coast of the United States. All the members of the party concealing their identity, even from the servants, by calling each other by their first names. That conference, in its ultimate results, was of the utmost importance to the United States. For then and there were formulated those fiscal devices, those financial methods, those monetary reforms, which have exerted an influence on every citizen, rich and poor, of the Republic. Much history was made in that little trip. It irresistibly calls to memory that other little trip, made in 1915, almost 2 years before America's entry into the war, by Bernard M. Baruch. As readers of the Dearborn Independent of November 27, 1920 will recall, Mr. Baruch had been financial backer of the Plattsburgh camp, and in his testimony he said he thought that General Wood would admit this. Then, I went off on a long trip, and it was while on this trip that I felt there ought to be some mobilization of the industries, and I was thinking about the scheme that practically was put into effect and was working when I was chairman of the board. When I came back from that trip, I asked for an interview with the president. The president listened very attentively and graciously, as he always does. Mr. Baruch was an authority on the president's demeanor, for there was a long period in 1917 and 1918 during which he called at the White House every afternoon.
Isn't that something? I thought that was amazing. Of course, that was during the war, and he was the head of this whole war thing, mobilization thing. But, and, you know, he dropped in at the White House to talk to the president every day.
And Wilson at that point didn't have all his marbles anyway.
Well, that's probably why he was there, telling everybody else what to do.
Yeah, maybe. Two momentous trips in our history, both of them signalized and given their principal meaning by the presence of Jews. Not that there should not have been Jews in either case. To insist upon their total exclusion would be going too far.
I disagree with that. I think that's amazing. Why shouldn't we? Why wouldn't they be totally excluded? Or why wouldn't there not be a Jew? You know, there's a Jew in every single thing. Everything, they say, well, there's just one Jew. Yeah, but he's in everything. You know, and when Jews are only like 2% of the population, why, you wouldn't have that many Jews naturally everywhere. And so they would be, not that they would be forced to be excluded, but they wouldn't be in everything that was
now
happening.
Carolyn, didn't you understand what Mr. Ford just said? He said to insist upon their total exclusion would be going too far. What are you, an extremist?
Yeah, because I think that's not. I think that's not going too far at all. But even if you didn't insist upon it, but if you, of course, he is saying insist. But even if you didn't insist upon it, but you wouldn't find it at all unusual, and you would find it unusual that everywhere you look, there's at least one Jew in there.
Yeah. I've noticed how many big time rock bands have one Jew in them.
Really?
Interesting thing. Yeah.
You just made that up.
The Jew as a citizen bearing his part is one matter. The Jew as a master directing the national show is quite another thing. It is by no means agreed that Barney Baruch was the only man in the United States who could have run this nation's war business. That is the explanation made of the high place he took. That he was the only man who could do it. Nonsense! If that be so, let us close up the nation and hand the keys over to the New York Kahila. Mr. Baruch could say, I probably had more power than any other man did in the war. Doubtless, that is true. But he had that power because he was, for the time, the head and front of the Jewish group for war purposes. If the explanation of Jewish mastery at critical moments were brains, well and good. But if it were, it would be more evident to the people. Brains do not need to be advertised. They advertise themselves. There is another reason.
Hey, you know, the Germans have already proven that you don't need Jews to do a good job, you know, to make your country successful. In fact, Germany, once they got rid of, once they got those Jews out of all those places and professions and so on, and their banks and their stores and their, you know, owning everything, and their newspapers and so on, they were doing fabulously well, better than ever. In fact, they recovered from the bad economy that they had. So that's a proof right there that nobody wants to pay attention to, at least not the politically correct people.
The British public recently awoke to the fact that not Lloyd George, but Mr. Montagu and Sir Alfred Mond were in charge of the recent negotiations over the German indemnities. These gentlemen are both Jews, one of them of German descent. Of all the British Empire, are they the only two men to advise the Premier in a great crisis? If they are, why is it? The Montagues, we know, control the silver of the world. Sir Alfred Mond, we know, turned the very neat trick of keeping the sign of the cross off the war memorials raised to the soldiers of the empire. Their Jewishness always so apparent. Both financiers, both the close advisers of the Premier, as Baruch to Wilson, so they to Lloyd George.
Okay, I want to make another comment here. That saying that this Jew Alfred Mond worked to keep the sign of the cross off the war memorials of the for the soldiers also gives the lie to the idea that Jews love Christianity because they invented it. And they, you know, they want people to be Christians and so on, which we hear so often, because the facts are, when you look at it, they absolutely hate Christianity and are always trying to blot it out. That's just one example.
Apparently, there are no Anglo-Saxons on either side of the sea capable of managing these deep matters, if we are to judge from the war administrations. Those that have passed off the stage, and those that still linger. Lloyd George, for once stung to the quick by the criticism of the British public of his tendency to closet himself with Jews when confronted with a crucial question, retorted bitterly, "With what? With what? With the old outworn Jewish propagandist boast that it ill became people who sang the Jewish songs in church to rag the race that wrote them."
Now, that's funny. Yeah. It's kind of terrible, though.
I doubt that any Jew wrote Jesus Loves Me, Yes, I Know, for the Bible.
Well, they're talking about the Psalms.
The Psalms. Oh,
hymns,
oh.
Hymns that are based on the Psalms.
Well, the Psalms actually are of Egyptian origin.
Well, whatever, you know, that they say things like that, you know, that, pushing the idea that the Jews are a religion and, you know, they were our original religion and all that stuff. And Lloyd George said that. And, you know, we try to think well of him because he said some nice things about Adolf Hitler. And he wasn't as bad as some of the rest of those British, but he said that. Defending the Jews.
A most illuminating defense. The world would give a good deal for a true psalm from Sir Alfred Mond, Mr. Montagu, or even Sir Philip Sassoon, who is soon to become the Premier's son-in-law. In our own history, Barney Baruch boldly claims his place. He unhesitatingly asserts that he had more power than any man in the war. If Allenby in Palestine needed a locomotive, if the Americans in Russia needed clothing, if the munition mills needed copper, it was Baruch who gave or withheld the word. Mr. Warburg, being of somewhat finer grain, probably due to his having less than Mr. Baruch of the rough experience of the street, Wall Street meaning, does not make the claim that he is the chief factor in the present monetary system of the United States, nor does the Dearborn Independent undertake to make it for him, lest the cry of anti-Semitism wax wrathful again. But fortunately, the fact is amply attested by a Jew whose knowledge of the matter is unquestionable. Readers have doubtless become aware by this time that for a non-Jew to say that a certain Jew is a most important factor in any field is to be guilty of anti-Semitism, while for a Jew or a Gentile front to say it is perfectly proper. It is a rather odd etiquette in which simple minds sometimes become confused. Professor E.R.A. Seligman of Columbia University is the sponsor of this great honor for Mr. Warburg. What Professor Seligman says is of such importance, both as to its source and its subject, that quotation is justified. The italics in all cases are ours. I'll try to read the italics. It is in a general way known to the public that Mr. Warburg was in some way connected with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, and his appointment to his present responsible position on the Federal Reserve Board was acclaimed on all sides with a rare degree of approval and congratulation. But I fancy it is known only to a very few how great is the indebtedness of the United States to Mr. Warburg. For it may be stated without fear of contradiction that in its fundamental features, the Federal Reserve Act is the work of Mr. Warburg more than of any other man in the country. When the Aldrich Commission was appointed, it was not long before Senator Aldrich, to his credit, be it said, was won over by Mr. Warburg to the adoption of these two fundamental features. The Aldrich bill differed in some important particulars from the present law. The concession in the shape of the 12 regional banks that had to be made for political reasons is, in the opinion of Mr. Warburg, as well as of the writer of this introduction, a mistake. For it will probably, to some extent at least, weaken the good results which would otherwise have followed. On the other hand, the existence of a Federal Reserve Board creates, in everything but in name, a real central bank. And it depends largely upon the wisdom with which the board exercises its great powers as to whether we shall be able to secure most of the advantages of a central bank without any of its dangers.
Okay, you know, Hadding, it sounds to me like there's a little bit of breakup in what you're saying. Not bad enough, and there's also a kind of a rumbling noise coming from behind you. I don't know what's going on with your connection, but we'll just leave it because it's okay. But I just wanted to say here that that yeah, the idea that I get is that Warburg agreed to make it 12 regional banks for propaganda purposes in order to allay the fears of the American public and their suspicions about this whole thing. But he really wanted just one bank, and that was and his supporters also say just one bank is what they needed, is what they wanted. But they had to go along with this 12 bank deal. But it is known that the New York Bank is one that really runs the whole thing, and the other banks just kind of go along with it, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, basically. Anyway, we still have the 12 banks, so I guess they haven't figured that they could get rid of that yet. American public is still suspicious.
In many minor respects also, the Federal Reserve Act differs from the Aldrich Bill. But in the two fundamentals of combined reserves and of a discount policy, the Federal Reserve Act has frankly accepted the principles of the Aldrich Bill. And these principles, as has been stated, were the creation of Mr. Warburg and of Mr. Warburg alone. It must not be forgotten that Mr. Warburg had a practical object in view. In formulating his plans and in advancing slightly varying suggestions from time to time, it was incumbent on him to remember that the education of the country must be gradual, and that a large part of the task was to break down prejudices and remove suspicions. His plans, therefore, contain all sorts of elaborate suggestions designed to guard the public against fancied dangers and to persuade the country that the general scheme was at all practicable. It was the hope of Mr. Warburg that with the lapse of time it might be possible to eliminate from the law not a few clauses which were inserted, largely at his suggestion, for educational purposes.
Yeah, see how he knew he had to persuade people. They were persuading the country. Actually, they just force it on, kind of. But, you know, it's not something that the people welcomed. That's for sure. Generally. Yeah. Sorry.
Just turning something off here.
Okay.
So that I can get a little more bandwidth.
All right.
That should help. As it was my privilege to say to President Wilson when originally urging the appointment of Mr. Warburg on the Federal Reserve Board, at a time when the political prejudice against New York bankers ran very high, England also, quarters of a century ago, had a practical banker who was virtually responsible for the idea contained in Peel's Bank Act of 1840. Mr. Samuel Jones Lloyd was honored as a consequence by the British government and was made Lord Overstone. The United States was equally fortunate in having with it a Lord Overstone.
You know, now this, you wouldn't know Samuel Jones Lloyd, but yeah. Where does he get the name Lloyd? But the Samuel might give you a little bit of a hint.
I don't know. Do you know that he was a Jew?
Well, isn't he implying here that he was a Jew? Because he's talking.
Not sure about that.
These other Jewish bankers. He was a practical banker who was responsible. Well, I wouldn't think that he'd bring it up if he wasn't a Jew. But anyway, I want to look that up.
The Federal Reserve Act will be associated in history with the name of Paul M. Warburg. That's pages 387 to 390, volume 4, number 4, Proceedings of the Academy of Political Science, Columbia University. It surely cannot be considered invidious for the Dearborn Independent thus to introduce to the people of the United States a gentleman whose influence upon the country is so vital. Just how vital can be understood only by those who have studied the puzzle of a country filled with the good things of life, and still unable to use them, or to share them because of a kink in the pipeline called money. But that Mr. Warburg himself is not entirely unaware of his position is indicated on page 56 of his testimony quoted last week. Mr. Warburg just told the Senate committee that he was making a heavy financial sacrifice to accept the position on the Federal Reserve Board offered him by President Wilson, and into the fitness of which appointment the Senate was carefully inquiring. Senator Reed, may I ask what your motive is or your reason for making that sacrifice? Mr. Warburg.
My motive is that I have, as you know, taken a keen interest in this monetary reform since I have been in this country. I have had the success, which comes to few people, of starting an idea and starting it so that the whole country has taken it up. And it has taken some tangible form.
Professor Seligman advises us of the strategy that was used to get the whole country to take up Mr. Warburg's idea, and of the fact that some of the items started to appease the public might easily be removed when the public shall have become accustomed to Mr. Warburg and the Federal Reserve Board. But Mr. Warburg adds another hint to the effect that you can do some things by administration which you cannot do by organization. For example, Mr. Warburg wanted only one central bank, which should be the sole arbiter of finance in the United States. The United States government would have almost nothing to do save to make the money and stand back of it. The bankers of the United States and the people thereof would have nothing to do except what they were told. The one central bank would be the real financial governing authority. When asked by Senator Bristow to state the fundamental difference between the Aldrich plan and the present Federal Reserve plan, Mr. Warburg replied.
Well, the Aldrich bill brings the whole system into one unit, while this deals with 12 units and unites them again into the Federal Reserve Board. It is a little bit complicated, which objection, however, can be overcome in an administrative way. And in that respect, I freely criticized the bill before it was passed.
There is evidently, then, a method of administration for which severe critics might even use the word manipulation, by which the plain provisions of a banking law, whatever they may be, if not evaded, then somewhat adapted. This idea is brought to mind by a more colloquial expression of Mr. Warburg's, to be found in his address on banking acceptances delivered in 1919.
In this connection, I'm reminded of a story I once heard concerning a man belonging to a species now soon to be extinct and to be found by our children in Webster's Dictionary only, the bartender. A man of this profession, in prehistoric times, was abandoning his position and was turning over his cash register to his successor. "Please show me how it works," said the newcomer. "I will show you how it works," said the other, "but I won't show you how to work it."
Ba-dum-bum-psh.
Well, I guess that is supposed to mean you manipulate it. He's not going to tell him how to manipulate it, right?
No.
I don't understand the whole bartender bit. That's crazy, but I don't know.
I don't know. Just conveys to me explaining something in a way that isn't
I know it's kind of dumb, but I will show you how the cash register works, but I won't show you how to work it. Kind of a confession.
Sly and clever there.
Yeah.
The politics of Mr. Warburg and the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company formed part of the inquiry, and Mr. Warburg made some interesting revelations, which illustrate the oft-repeated statement that it is part of Jewish policy, perhaps of large financial firms generally, to attach themselves to parties so that certain interests may be the winners regardless of which party is defeated. Senator Pomerene, what are your politics? Senator, wait a minute.
These are all senators.
Senator Pomerene, what are your politics? Senator Nelson, no, we have not raised that before this committee. Senator Reed, it has not been raised here, but I should like to know. Senator Pomerene, it has been raised before the Senate. I'm not understanding what's going on here. Senator Reed, I will say why I should like to know. Senator Pomerene, well, I have no objection to saying what was in my own mind. The chairman, I will say that I do not know what Mr. Warburg's politics are. Senator Pomerene, well, I did not. Senator Schaffroth, I do not know and I do not care to know. Senator Pomerene, I heard the statement made that the entire board was Democratic. I guess that means the Federal Reserve Board. And I had understood that Mr. Warburg was a Republican, or had been, in his affiliations, Mr. Warburg.
Yeah, I'll just say before I speak for Mr. Warburg that they just seem to be nervous about asking him about his politics. You know, the first guy asks him about his politics, and then these other senators all have to chime in and say, well, I don't care what they are, or either this or blah, blah. Anyway, Warburg doesn't mind, so he says, well, so I was, and my sympathies, that is, so I was what? Well, so I was, and my sympathies were entirely in the early campaign for Mr. Taft. Oh, he's saying so he was a Republican.
Yeah.
My sympathies were in the early campaign for Mr. Taft against Mr. Roosevelt in the first fight. When later on Mr. Roosevelt became President Wilson's opponent, my sympathies went with Mr. Wilson.
Senator Reed, well, you would count yourself a Republican, generally speaking, Mr. Warburg.
I would.
Senator Bristow, it has been variously reported in the newspapers that you and your partners directly and indirectly contributed very largely to Mr. Wilson's campaign funds, Mr. Warburg.
Well, my partners, there's a very peculiar condition. No. I do not think any of them contributed largely at all. There may have been moderate contributions. My brother, for instance, contributed to Mr. Taft's campaign.
Just what would you consider a moderate contribution to a presidential campaign?
Well, that depends who the man is who contributes. But I think anything below $10,000 or $5,000 would not be an extravagant contribution, so far as that should be.
Examination resumed another day. Senator Bristow. Now, Mr. Warburg, when we closed Saturday, some senator asked you in regard to political contributions, and I understood you to say that you contributed to Mr. Wilson's campaign.
No. My letter says that I offered to contribute, but it was too late. I came back to this country only a few days before the campaign closed.
So that you did not make any contribution?
I did not make any contribution, no.
Did any members of your firm make contributions to Mr. Wilson's campaign?
I think that is a matter of record. Mr. Schiff contributed. I would not otherwise discuss the contributions of my partners if it was not a matter of record. I think Mr. Schiff was the only one who contributed in our firm.
And you stated that your brother had contributed to Mr. Taft's campaign, as I understand it?
I did. But again, I do not want to go into a discussion of my partner's affairs, and I shall stick to that pretty strictly, or we will never get through.
I understand you also to say that no members of your firm contributed to Mr. Roosevelt's campaign.
I did not say that.
Oh, did any members of the firm do that?
My answer would please you, probably, but I shall not answer that, but will repeat that I will not discuss my partner's affairs.
Yes, I understood you to say Saturday that you were a Republican, but when Mr. Roosevelt became a candidate, you then became a sympathizer with Mr. Wilson and supported him?
Yes.
While your brother was supporting Mr. Taft?
Yes.
And I was interested to know whether any member of your firm supported Mr. Roosevelt.
It is a matter of record that there are.
That there are some of them who did?
Oh, yes.
Will you please indicate, or do you care to indicate, what members of your firm supported Mr. Roosevelt in that campaign?
No, sir. I shall have to go on the principle that I cannot disclose the business of a member of my firm.
What a nobleman. What a loyal business partner.
Yeah, you know, this Warburg really should, if I had the talent to use a German accent for him, because being so new from Germany, he had to have been speaking in a German accent, but I'm not doing it. People can imagine it.
The result was this, that in a three-cornered fight between three candidates, Roosevelt, Taft, and Wilson, the men who constituted the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, chief Jewish financial institution of the United States, distributed their support among all three. Schiff for Wilson, Felix Warburg for Taft, and an unknown for Roosevelt. Was that unknown Mr. Kahn? In any case, Wilson won, and the above combination relates to a member of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company receiving an important appointment which gave him large power over the finances of the United States.
Now, here's another thing that comes up. This Kuhn, we were learning last week, had his citizenship was under question, and now I understand better why they were going into that.
You mean Kahn?
Oh,
Otto Kahn.
That was Otto Kahn, and this is Kuhn Loeb. So anyway, Otto Kahn is in this same law firm. That's not his name, though. Thanks for pointing that out. But Mr. Kahn is in this law firm and a partner, and he's not a citizen of the United States. But this is a major United States bank. I don't know that. I suppose there's no laws against that at all.
I think they left it a little up in the air as to whether he actually was a U.S. citizen. They said if he were a U.S. citizen, that would be his third citizenship.
Right. So it seemed like it was pretty cloudy. And when he said he was going to vote, and then when people started questioning his citizenship, he got sick. He got ill before.
I don't feel so good.
Was just a story.
Excuse me, I have to go.
I think I read, though, that his father had come to the United States, had become a citizen, and then went back to Germany, I guess. But Kahn was born in Germany, and so that would make him a German citizen. He couldn't somehow take on American citizenship from his father, I don't think. Anyway, that's how that got in there, I guess.
Okay. The point of not discussing the affairs of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was frequently made by Mr. Warburg.
Oh, I cannot discuss the affairs of the firm, nor my partners, nor be asked to criticize acts of my partners, either to approve them or in any other way. I would like to say that before we come to the point where I would feel that I should not answer any questions, I would like to say that before we come to the point where I would feel that I should not answer any question,
said Mr. Warburg. The principle of this objection was conceded by the Senate committee, but that it ought to serve as a blanket injunction against a number of pertinent inquiries was doubted. Senator Bristow, but you are a partner in this firm. And have you not had something to do with its operations and its management?
Yes.
Does that not go to show your general views and practices as a financier and as a citizen and as a businessman?
Yes, but you have got to take them individually. I cannot permit my firm to be drawn into this discussion.
But how can you divest yourself from your firm when you have been one of the managers of the firm?
I shall divest myself of the firm.
If the firm has done something that I might think was improper, to illustrate, being called upon to say whether or not I approve your nomination to this responsible position, have I not a right to know what your attitude was in regard to that transaction which your firm performed?
Well, inasmuch as my answer there might be a criticism of my firm, I would beg to be excused, and I would leave it to the committee to draw its own conclusions.
In examining Mr. Warburg about the handling of $100 million, Southern Pacific Securities, the same difficulty was experienced. Mr. Warburg objected.
But we are getting here again into the transactions of my firm.
To which Senator Bristow retorted, when you participated in the profits of the transaction, is it not a part of your business life?
Certainly it is a part of my business life, and there is no reason why I should not be proud of it. But as a matter of principle, I think we should not get into a discussion of the business of my firm.
I am discussing your business.
No, you're discussing the firm's business.
Did you get any of the profits that came from the handling of this $100 million?
You may take it that whatever my firm did, I got my profits. My share in the profits.
Your share in the profits. Now, without being specific, I take it for granted that this was quite material. That was quite a material interest in size. That is, that you are one of the important members of the firm.
I am one of the important members of the firm.
Yes, I think the testimony and the report here show that you are the third important member, or the second, which is it, of the firm.
We are not numbered.
You are not. All right.
There is Mr. Jacob H. Schiff, who is the senior.
Yes.
And the others rank very much alike.
Yes. We may take it for granted, then, that whatever profits accrued to your firm in the handling of this business here, since you became a member of it, you participated in the profits as one of the partners?
Yes, sir.
Yes. So I will assume, then, that you participated in the marketing of $113 million of Union Pacific and so on. The responsibilities of a member of the Federal Reserve Board, especially such a member as Paul M. Warburg, would be, for it was recognized that because of his purpose and connections he would become a dominating factor. His responsibilities were very great, especially at the time when the appointment was being considered. They are as important now, of course, but in a different way. It is not now a question of military safety. This thought was evidently in the mind of the senators, as the following shows. Senator Hitchcock: Mr. Warburg, one of the important functions of the board is to guard the gold supply of the country, and it has been thought that this is very important to have men on the board who had at heart only the interests of the United States and had no foreign interests or alliances. You have said that you propose to divest yourself altogether of your banking connections in Germany. Have you any other interests in Europe?
See, now, here's where we get into the international aspect of all this. It's pretty interesting. Okay, Warburg says, no, not to speak of.
Mr. Warburg, yes.
I may have very unimportant things, like everybody has, but I could dispose of those. It would not amount to anything.
Mr. Senator Hitchcock, nothing in the line of banking?
No.
A few moments later, the chairman, Senator Owens, said, the date was August 1st, 1914, we are on the eve of a great European war, and the organization of this board is of great national importance. This time, Mr. Warburg was a member of the Hamburg firm. He testified, page 7.
I am going to leave my Hamburg firm, though the law does not require me to do so.
A part of the German firm of his father and brothers. A part of the American firm to which he and his brother were related by marital as well as financial ties. Mr. Warburg repeatedly said he would break off all business relationships so that he, like Caesar's wife, to quote himself, should be above suspicion.
Well, that's the completion of this chapter, and once again we ended quite earlier than usual. I have not been clear about this ending, though, so we can talk about this. I hope you're more clear than I am. Now, all of a sudden they brought in this idea of the 1914 World War One, and what was Warburg doing in that capacity? Well, we know that he was at the peace conference after the war and played a very important role there. But he was still in the Hamburg firm in 1914. I'm not following this very well or what. Because he became a U.S. citizen and finally completed that in 1911. Now, he continued to be a part of that law firm, of his family law firm in Hamburg up until that time then, huh? I mean, after he was a U.S. citizen and he was a part of this Kuhn Loeb company here, he was also still with his family's Hamburg firm. You think?
I'm not sure what you were asking me, really.
Well, when he says he's going to divest, he's going to leave the Hamburg firm, this was not until long after. This was not until the war. This was not until long after he became head of the Federal Reserve and designed the Federal Reserve and became a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
You know, if he became a U.S. citizen, he had to let go of his German citizenship, which is maybe, he says, is why it took him so long to do it. But, because it wasn't easy to do for him. But then he remained being a partner in the Hamburg law firm. I mean, they don't make this very clear here. And, I didn't look up this part. But it sounds like it, doesn't it?
Well, the main thing that I've gotten from this is that Kuhn Loeb and Company backed all three candidates in the three-way race of 1912, three-way presidential race, and they got a payback for it.
How do you mean they got a payback for it?
Well, in the terms of somebody being appointed by a
president. Yes. And whoever won, they would have had somebody to be appointed.
And the implication is that they benefited financially for it. In other words, that their political backing of all three candidates was an investment that they expected to be financially rewarding from whatever appointment they would get as a result of any one of the three being elected.
Yes, and their financial benefit from being appointed to these important positions was so far greater than any contribution they made, you know? I mean, they make about 100 times more than what they have to spend for it. But you're right, that's one of the main lessons of this chapter, for sure. And they want to point out that, or I don't know, we should point out that they're still doing that. They are on all sides, and people need to recognize that. I think people are. more and more. They're certainly functioning in the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and any other party. And they've got to be functioning in white nationalism. What about the idea of the Jews being in any kind of white pro-white party or any pro-white group even? They have to be here amongst us, too.
And, well, that doesn't make any sense.
What do you mean it doesn't make any sense?
if we want to run our own affairs, we have to run our own affairs even during the struggle to run our own affairs, don't we?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know that
I was looking at a book the last couple of days ago anyway, by Charles Lindbergh Sr., who was a congressman. I guess he was congressman from Minnesota. And he wrote this book. It was published in 1913, called Banking and Currency and the Money Trust, which has also been republished as Lindbergh and the Federal Reserve or something like that. And he talks about the financial situation before the Federal Reserve Act was passed. He claims that the same Jewish bankers, or the same bankers, he doesn't really focus on Jews specifically, they already had a control over booms and busts. He calls them the money trust. And he claims that they deliberately engineered a problem in 1907 so that they could propose a plan to have even more power than they already had. He says that by controlling booms and busts, they have enormous opportunities as speculators.
Well, right. Now, that's direct conspiracy when they control booms and busts. So who is it? Who again wrote this, did you say?
It's Charles Lindbergh Sr.
Oh, Charles Lindbergh. Okay. Well, what's your opinion of that?
That's true. I mean, obviously, anybody that can control the money supply and have foreknowledge of how it's going to be changed can make enormous amounts of money. There's one conspiracy theory that the stock market crash in 1929 was deliberately triggered by the Federal Reserve by changing the money supply. Some people who had foreknowledge of that could make huge amounts of money, buy up other people's concerns.
Well, okay, we've still got six or at least 5 minutes left. So if anybody would like to call in, there's still time to do so.
I mean, you Federal Reserve cranks, come on.
At 830-443-4911. Start with a 1. And, if you're outside of the United States. So, I'm looking at this ending here, and it says that these questions of Warburg here, this date was August 1st, 1914, at least these last ones were. And it says that Senator Owen said, and the date was August 1st, 1914, we're on the eve of a great European war and blah, blah. And the organization of this board is of great national importance. He must have been talking about the Federal Reserve Board, or is he talking about some other board? I think this is about the Federal Reserve. And Warburg, at that time, was a member of the Hamburg firm, he says. So in 1914, he was still a member of that firm, the law firm in Germany, along with being the member here. And he said, I am going to leave my Hamburg firm, though the law does not require me to do so. So at that was when he thought he better do it to look better, because he was going to be doing all this stuff for the United States during wartime, during this European war. That's pretty interesting. It's not illegal, but it's just pretty interesting what these people, what these Jews get away with.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What's needed, though, is see, this is all, in a way, this is all innuendo. Because, you know, you're saying, well, they supported all three presidential candidates, and they probably expect, we can infer that they expected to get a payoff from it because somebody was appointed as a result. But that's, it's just an inference, really.
I know, we shouldn't be stupid. I mean, if they've got a law firm there, and each one of them, they say, oh, well, he likes this candidate, and this other one likes this candidate, and this other partner likes a different candidate. And so they're really just like these candidates, and they want to support them. That's, you'd have to be pretty darn naive, in fact, stupid, to believe that. And, you know, I mean, I think this is part of our problem as whites, that we want to be so naive about these things and not accuse them of anything unless we have absolute, some kind of proof where they've said, I'm doing this because we're trying to make a lot of money off this, you know. Well, they admit all this stuff. That's our problem.
It does look fishy for sure.
Well, it is fishy. I mean, you know why they're doing it. They're doing it to have a friend and all three of these candidates. So.
This is Lindbergh here. He says, there is a man-made God that controls the social and industrial system that governs us. We know him as the Money Trust. He is offended if given or called by his true name, and being jealous of his power, he opposed an investigation of its sources. At the present time, he has an almost illimitable influence upon our daily actions, and is seeking to increase it by framing new currency and banking laws to suit his purposes. See, Lindbergh Sr. Apparently, he led the opposition to the adoption of the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
We get less for what we sell because the speculators manipulate the markets against us. And what we buy costs us more because the speculators control the prices of commodities. We take the losses and they take the profits both ways.
You know, there's all kinds of people against these things, and they made very persuasive cases. And we've been against all kinds of things all along, all through our history, and yet these Jews managed to push through what they want. Every time. Almost every time. Probably not every time. But too often. And, it gets so discouraging that no matter how many people are against something, you don't hear. Look at the people who are against this United States going and bombing Syria for six months. You know, they got 6 months that they can do that. And, everybody's against it, but they just think they can do it anyway, and nobody
60%.
Knows what to do about it.
60% are against it, 10% are for it. Thing is, if they let this gassing accusation continue, it'll be brought up in a few years as additional evidence in, you know, for some other provocation, and then they'll do with, if they don't get to do it now, they'll do their attack then.
Well, it's so phony. It's just so phony, and people see through it, but it doesn't do us any good because they've got everything locked up. In criminal ways. So, well, this is the end of our show for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And then, naturally, we will be back next week for another chapter. Thanks for listening.
Rage, 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 I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.